This is Barbara Peters, and it is Monday, the 9th of April, and we are here actually a day before the publication of the 14th Lincoln Rhyme novel, The Cutting Edge.
Exciting, wow. Isn't it, Barbara?
It really is.
You were kind of joking a little bit, but I remember the thrill I got when I saw my first novel in the bookstore. And I never got over that feeling. And on the eve of a new publication, I still get that excitement, looking forward to seeing it in the stores, especially yours, if I may add. And I hope that never goes away.
I hope it doesn't either, because if you get bored, your readers may be bored. Yeah. But I think it's exciting. We're actually doing a double event tonight, you and Lisa Scannellini, both of you, on the eve of publication, which I find interesting because I pioneered this for a long time, and now it's becoming kind of a regular thing in the same way that for a long time I pioneered having authors appear together. Mm-hmm. I think years ago, publicists used to think that, say, a star like you wouldn't want to share the spotlight. But the truth is we become more of an entertainment venue, and book signings have really become theater. Well, it works better to have two people.
Oh, it absolutely does. And, you know, my theory about a presentation, and I've been doing book signings now for, I guess I will have to tell the truth, about 35 years. I'm not a spring chicken anymore. But the goal I have is to entertain the audience. I have rarely done a reading, and if I do a reading, I edit it down so that it has the most emotional impact. Generally, I just get up and talk, try to tell a funny story about my career as a writer. I remember a signing I did about 10 years ago, and a woman came up to me afterwards, and she said, "Mr. Deaver, I'm quite cross." And I thought, uh-oh, what have I done now? And I asked her what it was. She said, "You know, when I saw you up on stage, you were nice, you were funny. Having read your books, I expected you to be the model of an evil author like the characters that you write about." And I think the presentation should really engage the audience, teach them about you. If there are two authors, you can play on that symbiosis and have a lot of fun.
You can indeed, and actually Lisa Scannellini could have a whole second career as a stand-up comedian, so you and I may just be playing catch right behind you.
I think that's trying to make people laugh is the best thing in the world, although I've tried my hand at humorous books, and that doesn't work. It's a skill that Carl Hiaasen has, that P.G. Woodhouse has. I never got that. I like to put a little bit of humor in. Lincoln Rhyme, my main character, he delivers some wry lines occasionally, but a purely humorous book, that's just not in me.
Lincoln Rhyme has developed so interestingly over time. When we first met him, he was a full paraplegic, but now you've given him the ability to do at least a small movement.
Sure. One of the things I found in writing all my books is that you really have to be accurate when you do the research. And one of the problems I had with Lincoln was that the quadriplegic condition that he suffers from has been changing over the years. There are now so many prosthetic devices, there are electronic systems, there's a lot of surgery experimental techniques and so forth, and I have to stay true to that. Otherwise, fans would say, oh no, he needs to go through this procedure or that procedure. But, you know, in essence, Lincoln has always been and will continue to be his mind before anything else. That was his whole genesis. I wanted a thriller hero who had to use his brain cells, like Poirot, of course, to outthink the villain rather than pull out a gun at the last minute, a la Tom Cruise or Bruce Willis in a thriller movie. And however much he improves, he'll still rely on his brain before anything else.
At the moment, I think people must be reminded of the late Stephen Hawking and how,
yes,
amazingly, you know, despite the ravages of ALS, thanks to technology, he was able to the end to make some kind of communication. Was it like an eye? I'm trying to remember. It was like a blink or something. So, or twitch in his cheek was so tiny.
Yeah, and I remember in college, during one year, I had a roommate who was paraplegic, disabled. And I must be honest, I was a little nervous, uncomfortable at first, because I had known no one who had a physical disability like that. And yet, after about 3 weeks, I forgot entirely about it. I'd say things like, "Hey, come on, Ken, let's go for a walk," and then I'd pause and think, "Oh, wait a minute, he can't walk," but it didn't matter because, you know, I kind of looked past that, and that's what I want to bring to Lincoln Rhyme if I can.
Well, I think you've done an excellent job. For one thing, you've now allowed him to get married, which was never in the cards at the outset. Yeah. And another new thing, which I've really been enjoying, is that you've let him travel. He's not just New York-based. I loved your book set in Italy.
Oh, well, thank you.
And in this new book, there's a whole lot about South Africa because we're talking about diamonds and diamond mines of all kinds, and you've brought in is it Pakistan? Is that where? Right.
Pakistan. Well, Pakistan and India as well.
Exactly, yeah. Because of the skills of the diamond cutters, but also the first victims, so to speak, in this thing are of that nationality, but working in New York. So I think it's great that Lincoln can now travel, and you're getting a broader remit for him.
Well, someone had said, well, Italy, you know, it's not really a very accessible country. I go there quite frequently, and it isn't. And I know you travel a great deal as well. And, you know, we have the Americans with Disabilities Act here. Some countries have certain accommodations. But the fact is, even in New York, the most vibrant city in the world, Lincoln is happy to sit in a dark room and ponder the evidence. So I take him to Italy. Amelia gets out, and she was hoping for a Ferrari or Maserati to chase the bad guys in, and what does she end up with? A little tiny Renault with 140 cubic inch engine in it, and so she didn't get quite to burn up the pavement the way she would have liked to, but I think they had a good time on their trip to Italy, and as you say, they tied the knot over there.
They did, and you know, in a way, Nero Wolfe and Archie Goodwin were a little bit of the same structure as Rhyme and Sachs, in the sense that Wolfe, while he wasn't handicapped, didn't like to leave his townhouse. He was there cooking and doing orchids and things. And Archie was his leg man out there in the streets of New York.
And they were largely a model for my series, as was Sherlock Holmes. The true model was Mycroft Holmes. And many people don't know that Mycroft was the more reclusive, and yet by Sherlock's admission, the smarter, more perceptive brother. And he never left the club. And if Sherlock had a problem, he would go to the club, present it, Mycroft would fall silent for a moment, and then give Sherlock a beautiful description of what he needed to do next.
Well, that was true of Mycroft and also of Wolfe, but they chose to stay inside, whereas Lincoln...
Right, Lincoln doesn't have much,
so
doesn't have much choice. Right,
right. So, I know how much you love research, and you must have had a great time with the diamond industry, which is the backbone of the story.
Absolutely true, although I will point out that my girlfriend said, Jeff, let me understand this. You wrote The Burning Wire about the infrastructure grid, and you actually went to places where they have big substations and found that interesting. You actually had a lot of clues in the broken window about data mining and talked to data miners for that. And you certainly talked to people in the diamond industry, but I didn't see that you made any purchases to come back and show me that you had, in fact, been researching the 46th Street and 47th Street, the diamond district in New York. I may have to remedy that when her birthday comes up in 2 months. But, I did. And, you know, Barbara, I love research so much. But as with all of my books, The Cutting Edge required me to adhere to the Goldilocks rule. And I call the Goldilocks rule this with research: not too much and not too little. If you just tease and look like you really haven't done your homework, readers catch that in a minute, and they say you're kind of phoning in these details. If you put in too much, they get a little bored, go on for page after page. In The Cutting Edge, there's a scene where Vimal Lahore, who is a young South Asian living in New York, a U.S. citizen, but of South Asian extraction, grew up in Kashmir, is a brilliant sculptor, artistic sculptor, but he's kind of roped into cutting diamonds, very high-end diamonds, by his father, who's a very domineering character, and insisting that his son go into this business and carry on the family tradition. Well, he is enlisted to cut an unusual-shaped diamond. He isn't quite sure what to do with it until suddenly the stone speaks to him. And I wrote a scene where there's no violence, there are no bad guys around. He simply is confronting how to turn this rough diamond into the most beautiful thing he can. It's about 3 pages, and I was very concerned that that was too much information. In other words, I used too much research in this. And in fact, I cut it down a little bit in the final portion of the book. But everyone who's read that says they got more chilled reading his battle to make this diamond into something important and beautiful. more than the car chase scenes and the shoot 'em up scenes.
Well, part of that may be the novelty, but part of it, no doubt, is your craft. I mean, if you think back to the Kohinoor, you know, that diamond was enormously larger than the one that's currently in the English Crown
Jewels. And was cut down two or three times, I think. And unfortunately, the word is they put a coulet at the bottom. Coulet is cutting a flat. Well, a coulet is the bottom of a diamond. You can either have a flat or a pointed coulet. Generally, coulet means you cut it flat, and that eliminates some of the light. So Vimal, my hero, as I mentioned, had a chance to see photographs of the Kohinoor. It's in the Royal Jewels, of course, and was disappointed. He said, there's a dark spot in the diamond. I would never have done that.
It was a great line. Actually, I thought of you when I read it. And back to Rob and I, we're in South Africa, and we took a trip on Rovis Rail from Pretoria back to Cape Town. And
isn't that a beautiful trip?
It's a wonderful trip, and you know, it's a Victorian train, but they began it by restoring the old Victorian train, and then they decided they would have to simply build a new train based on the same, because it didn't. There were various problems with trying to run the old cars.
Well, it was quite old, of course, 200 years.
Yes, and it was. But anyway, one of the stops that they made on the trip was to see the Kimberley Diamond Mine, you know, the huge De Beers facility. And it's not unlike going over to Morenci, Arizona, and looking into the copper mine. You know,
it's astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah, there's just this huge hole in the earth. But what's really interesting is the Diamond Museum that you get to tour. And they, many of the things that you wrote about in your book are, you know, various facets of it are on display. Well, and of course, if you go to Bruges or if you go to Amsterdam, where there are major diamond cutters, one of the touristy things you can do is, you know, go visit and watch them at work.
Yeah, and I've seen some of them, and I haven't been to Bruges. I've been to the Amsterdam cutters. The one place I did not go that I was fascinated with, and I learned this through research, and there were no scenes actually set there. It was recounted, so I felt that I was playing fair by not trying to recreate them through my own eyes, but the Russian mines. In Siberia, for instance, the huge mines require, in the winter, they have to produce all year long. They require jet engines mounted on huge scaffoldings to heat the ground enough so that the workers can get down in the pits, and then they can only dig for a few hours. It freezes again, bring in the jet engine again.
Wow.
Now, not to say those are the most healthy working circumstances in the world, and they may have contributed to the personality of a particularly nasty character in my book. You know, I love creating my villains, and Vladimir Rostov is not somebody you'd necessarily want to sit down with a glass of vodka and enjoy.
No. Well, we've talked about the Lincoln Rhyme books, but over the time you and I have been together, which, Lord, is now, what, 25 years
or something? At least 25 years.
Well, this is year 29 for the store, so we might even be up that high.
Yeah.
But in any case, I have been with you through all kinds of different books besides Lincoln Rhyme. What's going on with Catherine Dance?
Oh, well, Catherine Dance, for your listeners who may not be familiar with her, is a California Bureau of Investigation agent. She's a kinesics expert, somebody who follows body language. You can sit down across from her and she watches you, and over the course of about 5 minutes, decide you're telling the truth or not. I thought it was a brilliant idea to create somebody with that skill. I introduced her in a Lincoln Rhyme book, and fans just loved her. And I have to back up for a minute here, Barbara. I'm teaching a course through the Mystery Writers of America. It's called Writing Commercial Fiction. And one of my points is that we need to stay very attuned to the marketplace. And by that I mean, I'm not talking about making money here, I'm talking about giving readers what they want. And the reality is, the Lincoln Rhyme books do much better than the Catherine Dance books. There are more people who like them. When I write a Catherine Dance book, and she has a good-sized following, but when I write a Catherine Dance book, that means I cannot write a Lincoln Rhyme book.
Sure.
And so I have tended not to do Catherine for the last couple of years. I have a book outlined. I will be turning to that within the next year or so. And I do apologize to my fans, but I am, there's nothing wrong with this at all, but I am not somebody who could, like, farm out the work to somebody else. I can't do that. And I respect authors who do, because why? It gets books into the hands of their readers But I just don't play well with others. I was the kid in the playground who would say, no, I want to build my own castle. You go away.
Well, it's certainly true for every book you write. There's at least one book that you don't write. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe two books a year is a heavy burden. But I was also thinking about some of the other things you've done. For example, Carte Blanche. I loved Carte Blanche. Tell us about that.
That was great fun. About 7 or 8 years ago, I recall I was driving down I-95. This is how much I remember the incident. And I got a call from my agent. Now, and here's an admonition to everybody listening now. When you get a call on the highway, what you do is you turn off at the next exit and take the call. You do not talk on the phone. Have I done my public service now, Barbara? Have I said
that?
Okay, good. Thank you. So I pulled off because why? It was a call from my agent, and we never want to neglect the possibilities that might lead to. And she said, Jeff, I just got a call from Ian Fleming Publications, the company that publishes the new James Bond books. For your listeners who don't know, Ian Fleming passed away in the 1960s, and other authors have taken over writing the Bond character. And she said, they would like you to write the next James Bond novel. So I debated easily 5 seconds and said yes. And then on the rest of the drive home, I had some thoughts. And talk about chutzpah or hubris. I called my agent back and I said, I'll do it. I don't know how to put it delicately, but I'll do it on two conditions. And don't phrase it that way, but to say Jeff wants to do it. However, he's got a couple of concerns. And the first thing I was concerned about was that I had to write a Deaver book. And by Deaver book, I mean a book that takes place over a few days, that has lots of reversals in it, 3 or 4 surprise endings. That's just the kind of book I write. Ian Fleming did not write that kind of book. He did not have surprises or twists. We knew the good guy at the beginning. We knew the bad guy. There were some questions about how Bond would best the bad guy and how the bad guy would then come back against Bond. But pretty much it was a linear story. And we read them for the color of the characters and the atmosphere. It was not to have an emotional experience through the plot. I don't do that. And that was condition number one. Condition number two was that I set the book in the present day because none of the other books had done that. We know from the Bond movies, Bond is a character that is brought into the present time, but not for the books. And I didn't want to write a period piece because I wanted young readers to do what I had done, to meet a realistic, gritty, honorable hero who would sacrifice his life to take down the bad guy and who led a very exotic and appealing life, but also had a very dark side to him. And I remember reading my first Bond book at 8 or 9, a little young, maybe. I didn't get some stuff, but nonetheless, I knew this was a hero. I wanted to create a hero that was identical to that, who was fighting, not in Bond's case, the Cold War, contemporary villains back then, but the villains that we have now, either terrorists or some other corporate evil characters that I don't want to mention, in case your listeners want to go out and take a look at the book. And that was acceptable to them. I thought it was fine. There were not too many objections, although Anthony Horowitz, who went on to write another of the Bond books, said he didn't understand why I had said it in the present day, that Bond should have been true to the time. He did add that he hadn't read it, but was making that criticism simply based on press material. But, you know, I think 90-95% of the people enjoyed Bond, of the readers and critics, enjoyed Bond being a hero for the present day.
I thought it was a really interesting thing to do. I know that you decided, you know, not to make a series of it, but to do that one book. And in fact, Anthony has the second one coming out at the end of May. Mm-hmm. But he also likes to write sort of, you know, period things.
He does.
Himself.
He did the Sherlock Holmes books. And,
yeah. And, you know, he did an Agatha Christie thing. And so he's comfortable, mm-hmm.
yeah.
I think, in that time. But I thought that a strength of Carte Blanche was the modern update. And when we did the event for it, we had a film professor put together, remember that? Whole Bond.
That was so.
It was so much fun.
That was so well done.
It was. Scenes from the movies and all kinds of collage. It was just wonderful.
Of course, I'm curious now. I heard, now this is purely speculative, and you and your and your listeners may know better, I heard that Daniel Craig was maybe doing one more, and then that was going to be it for Bond. So I always wonder who the new Bond will be.
I don't know, but it changes, you know, every time.
I'd like to be a villain, frankly.
You could.
Yeah,
you could actually. You'd be a great Bond villain.
Thank
just,
you
know, kind of stroke your beard.
Do I have to carry a... What did he have, a cat? Persian cat? I'd, you know, Barbara, I'd break the mold. I'd get a pet ferret. I'd just do something a little different.
Yeah. It certainly would. All right. Two more I want to run through quickly. Garden of Beasts, mm-hmm. which is one of my favorite of all your books. And that one is a World War II book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a book that took me 2 years to write. Huge amount of research. The outline was over 200 pages. And as you know, some of your listeners may not, I don't write the book until I've done the complete outline, and I mean an exhaustive outline. I know exactly where the plot's going to go, and I do my research at the same time. It takes about 8 months for a typical book. That took about 12 months, took about a year to do the outline and get all the research together, because it was a period piece, and I had to make it accurate. And because it was such a volatile time, and the evil of Hitler, even at that point in 1936, was so endemic and so egregious, I wanted to make sure I got it exactly right. It was such a terrible time, and there were so many missteps. We knew, Americans knew, American intelligence knew, Hitler was rearming, and we did nothing about it. England knew, we did nothing about it. So I wanted to make sure it was completely accurate. And one of the best compliments I've ever had in a book signing was a man, a quite elderly man, who came up and said that he was in Berlin in 1939, and they escaped. They were able to get out, a Jewish family. They were able to get out. And he read the book, obviously when he had settled in America many, many years ago, and said it was the most accurate portrayal of the paranoia going on in Berlin at that time since I Am a Camera, which was the book upon which they based the play, A Cabaret. And I was very, very moved by that because I tried so hard. And he liked the story. The story was a very fast-paced story. But he said that brought home to him what life was like to live in this truly psychotic time.
And at the time you published it, it was an historic piece. But scarily enough, if you were to bring it back today, it's almost a contemporary piece.
I'll make only one comment about that. I tend not to talk politics. However, there are two schools of thought about why Hitler targeted the Jews. One is that he truly believed there was something pernicious about the Jewish religion and the culture. The other was that he did not care less about that at all. He had no animosity toward Jews, had no animosity toward Roma, the gypsies. What he needed was an enemy, right, to bring together his base, I guess one might say. I throw that out for what it's worth.
Well, I think I've always sort of favored the second one, although it was not a sound mind person. But I was actually referring to the rise of anti-Semitism again in Germany, the whole
right movement.
The Hungarian election that just showed us, you know.
The Czech Republic, Poland.
I know.
Sisi. Look at, mentioned Erdogan, and you've been to Turkey many times, correct?
I have, but not again, and in fact, we're going to Budapest in the fall, and I'm thinking it may be my last time to Budapest if it goes this way.
Yeah.
I do think that, I said to Rob, my husband, when Angela Merkel made her decision to, you know, just open the doors, that she was probably going to destroy the EU mm-hmm. by doing that, that it was an emotional decision and a humanitarian decision, but it was going to play very badly. I think it has worked out. So my political was actually focused more on Europe than it was on this country, but we're also seeing rise of fascism and anti-Semitism here, too.
In my book, The Burial Hour, the theme of it is... I'll give a little bit away because I think it's important. A fast-paced serial killer sort of book, but the core of it really has to do with the asylum seeking, that is what we would say undocumented folks coming in from North Africa, and how the right wing there, huge right of Italian, Italian party in the north, I hesitate because I can't truly call it fascist, but they have fascist leanings, highly anti-immigrant, a plot to plant in some of the innocent, among the innocent immigrants, basically hired killers to portray themselves as terrorists to make the people of Italy and the parliament believe that it's a mistake to allow these people in, that it's a cover for terrorists, which has happened on one or two occasions, not like it's a big problem. So anyway, I couldn't avoid a little bit of politics there.
There's a very interesting new thriller publishing this month, which is playing off that. I'm not going to identify it because I don't want to ruin the plot, but very similar. Tell me a little bit about The October List, because that's a book I've always thought you wrote for you.
It's funny you say for me, Barbara, because when I teach my courses, I say generally we write for our fans. They're the gods. We want to make them happy. But occasionally, if you have an idea that you think might appeal to, say, a smaller group, I think that's fine. Go for it. And my example is, and some authors think it's a little weird I say this, my example is toothpaste. We mostly like mint-flavored toothpaste or cinnamon-flavored toothpaste, but there are a few people who like, I think it's, I'm not giving a product plug here, Tom's, I think it's called. It's like a healthier baking soda toothpaste, something that's good for you, and they prefer that. Well, I would say that The October List is my Tom's toothpaste in this sense. It's a novel that is not for everybody. It was my second novel of that year, so people had a Lincoln rhyme to fall back on if they wanted to. But it's a curious creation. It goes backwards. It opens with chapter 36, and as you read through the book, the chapters go back in time, so that when we come to chapter 3, everything we've read, the people we've met, are somebody entirely different from whom we thought they were. Chapter 2, that happens again. I turn everything on its head. And the first chapter, we realize who is who, what's going on, and it's entirely different from anything we thought the book was about. The Daily Standard in England gave it a review that I should frame and put up on my wall. It said, I'm paraphrasing a bit, but this is very close, The October List by Jeffrey Deaver is a work of true genius and one which he must never, ever do again.
Well, the reason I said I thought you might have written it for yourself is that you're a writer who really likes to test himself. Mm. And it was an incredible challenge, I think, to construct a book. I mean, I was awed when I read it. We did an event for it, and it was really fun to talk about it. But I think, craft is one of the things, not just your fans, but craft is one of the things that truly absorbs you. Mm. And you've done a number of things, I think, where you get a chance. But when I think of you, I've often quoted one of my totally favorite things you ever said to me, or said to a group of people here, in fact. We were talking about outlining and revision. And I remember you saying, if they would let you, you would hang by your heels on a trapeze yes. over the press
exactly.
as it was spinning
exactly.
so that you could continue to revise it. Oh. And, you know, you're such a perfectionist. But you've also learned that if you're going to publish at some moment in time, you have to let it go.
It is a business, and we are manufacturers of products. You are the wholesaler and retailer, and you are a producer of products. Well, you have your publishing arm and producing many wonderful books, but you understand that it really is not a lot different structurally from making cars or making toothpaste. And so what that means is we have to, at some point, take what we've created and give it to the audience who wants it. And it's almost greedy for us to hang on a little too long. I'm happy with doing a book a year. I wish I had more energy to do that. I also do probably 6 or 7 short stories a year, and although they are short, you know, that adds up to about, 200-300 pages of actual writing and research I have to do as well to produce what I think is a quality short story. So at some point, you've got to say goodbye to your baby and take a deep breath and move on to something else.
Short stories have really been one of your great métiers. You've won some Daggers, which are the British version of the Edgar Allan Poe Award.
3 Ellery Queens. And
right.
I'm nominated this year for my 5th Edgar for a short story of mine. But I have a feeling I might end up being the Susan Lucci of the Edgars. I will keep my fingers crossed. I would like to win at some point, I think, but I'll keep going with the nominations until it becomes a ridiculous number.
sort of like Ricky Fowler just losing the Masters. It was a fascinating, you know, if you tried to write yesterday's golf match, which I, once a year, that's the sporting event that I watch.
Oh, really?
Sunday at Augusta. I absolutely love the Masters. Since occasionally it's disappointing. Yesterday's was amazing. But I thought about Ricky Fowler, you know, sort of always a bridesmaid.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
right
yeah.
up to the end. And the fact that eventually people stop rooting for a golfer they think just can't do it. Before Phil Mickelson won, there was that, that whole thing.
Sure.
And I also thought, talking about brands and, you know, fans, that they were so busy chasing Tiger and Phil that they forgot to notice some.
Yeah.
And so it was nice they faded away and let the new golfers, you know, have a larger moment. Well, you've obviously had a fabulous career, 35 years, and probably never going to slow down, because my observation is, after nearly 30 years of doing this, that writers write. And, you know, when people say to me, why don't you retire? And I say, what would I do? And I think that would be true, although you might like to slow down.
I might like to slow down a little bit. I mean, I'm in my late 60s at this point. And this year, some of it's been personal, but this year for book-related things, I've flown 60,000 miles, and it's April. I've got a British tour ahead of me. I've got an Italian tour ahead of me, and about four or five conferences throughout the rest of the year. And you and Rob are world travelers. You know, it's tiring. It does get to you.
It is tiring. Yeah, we're slowing down some because it is exhausting and there's so much work to do. Having said that, we're going to Eastern Europe in September, and we've decided to go to Sicily for Christmas and circumnavigate the island. David Hewson, a wonderful British author.
Oh, I know David quite well.
Told Rob that the best food in Europe was to be found in Sicily. So
And wonderful wines, the home of Marsala, Marsala, of course, and they have many other great wines there. And oh my gosh, there's so many wonderful places to
go. It's sort of like Iceland. It's an island, and you do
With a volcano, too.
You do it by circumnavigating it, which is the same. I've circumnavigated Iceland. And yes, so you can go to Etna, or if you really wanted to be brave, you could take a boat and go out and see Stromboli, but I don't think we will. In any case, it's been wonderful to chat with you.
As always,
and we're now going to go off and meet Lisa and do
Sell some books, right? That's what it's all about.
We could do that.